microphone? Talk to me.
Hello, hello, hello.
Indeed you are.
Yeah.
That's a good start.
Good.
So you can't hear what's in my headphones, so I could have all sorts of strange...
You can do it. Do you want me to listen?
Strange music behind us. So I'll ask them. I'm gonna pretend that I'm, you know, like in the movie High Fidelity for a second and okay. Do that, you know, like I'm the 13-year-old kid asking questions.
Okay.
Which, you know, the first question that 13-year-old kid would ask is, how's the tour going and where have you been and all of that stuff?
The tour's going very well. I've been to, started off in Boston, then New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia, Seattle, and now San Francisco. So it's been a good laugh. It's like an informal sort of impromptu, it's like an intimate type show, just an acoustic type show. So it's, for me, it's a bit like going back to basics, you know? It's like starting all over again.
Okay, so now this is the big test of someone who's on tour of all those cities. Can you name a tourist attraction in every one of those cities?
It's
a joke.
I'm going to work backwards.
This is a test, and he's going
Space
for
Needle.
It. Space Needle.
The Independence Hall.
Very nice.
The, take your pick, Statue of Liberty, Tony Soprano. Did I do any of these things?
Yeah.
Well, not really, but my girlfriend's from New York, so I'm kind of reasonably familiar with New York, and I spent actually Easter, I came out a bit earlier, and I came out about 2 weeks ago and spent Easter out in Connecticut. We did the All-American Easter, so that was the beginning of the tour for me, like doing the Easter bunny hunts with kids and stuff like that. So I haven't really been a tourist so much on this tour as a traveling salesman or whatever else I am, I don't know.
Well, no, I was just wondering, because if you got to meet Tony Soprano, I'm just jealous.
Yeah, well, I actually came out last year and went to, on 4th of July, I went with my girlfriend's family to this Italian family's 4th of July, whatever they have, barbecue in Connecticut, and it was definitely walking into an episode of Sopranos, and I know that if I ever need anybody taken care of,
you're all set in
the East Coast. I've got contacts now, so
those are good contacts to have. So, people have called you, and I want to watch the look on your face, because you know when someone starts a sentence with "people have called you the," right. You don't know what's going to be.
It could be anything.
Oh come on, you have a dog on. You know, I mean, what could they possibly? What could I possibly? You've been called the Scottish Todd Rundgren.
Oh, have I?
Yes, you have. Somebody that I kind of grew up with. And, you know, the reason I think is that he recorded a lot of stuff in the 70s. You know, way back then, you know, in the analog days, he had a 4-track TAC reel-to-reel machine.
Uh-huh.
And eventually he built this, you know, big Bearsville studios. But he did it by himself. And then eventually, obviously... You know, he went into bigger studios.
He became a proper producer, yeah.
Well, I don't know if he ever became proper.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anybody
ever...
A producer. So, tell me a little bit, because I know the first album definitely was that way, and the second album you went...
Well, it's a bit of a misconception, really. Both albums have been recorded in some senses the same way. Both recorded in the same studio in Glasgow. You know, in terms of actually how I record in the studio, it was done, Lost, the first record, and Us, the new album, both done in the same studio. I produced it myself, you know, played most of it myself. And for each album, I had maybe about 30, 35 songs. But more in the case of the first record, yeah, you're right. I did have, like, I tried to include a bit more of the sort of lo-fi kind of DIY way of recording. I had... recorded at home for years. I recorded in 4-track since I was about 14. I probably got about 400 songs currently in my brother's garage in a box, and because I'm supposedly moving. But so I had all these songs to call on. But you know, Lost was really about the songs I was writing at that time. It wasn't a case of regurgitating 400 old songs. But I did, in the course of that, include some of the dictaphone ideas. Some of just me. I mean, I constantly around sending messages to myself on my mobile and stuff, any ideas. So there is bits and pieces of that on both albums, you know, a little bit of the sort of, it's almost like the original time the song came into my head, the first time, including that. So they were kind of both recorded the same way, really.
But
a short answer.
No, that's a good answer, but, well, I don't know if it could be a bad answer anyway, but to continue the Todd thing for a second, it's, your songs are kind of for everyone. I think that Katie's dad, Katie, our producer in the studio here, would love your music. I think my wife, who likes different things than I do, would love your music. And I'm not saying it's pop per se.
Yeah.
But it's in a place, and we'll get to this a little bit more. It really is, you know, nobody can turn around and say, I don't like that. So when you write, yeah. I think I know the answer to this, but I'll ask it and see if I get an interesting answer. You're not really writing for any audience in particular. You're not setting out to do anything per se.
No, there's no kind of like goal or objective. I just write what I think I like. And I suppose maybe that means that I've listened to a lot of things and a lot of different experience or influences. So I'd like to think that what I do doesn't alienate. I mean, I've got a cousin who loves like drum and bass, loves, you know, and he comes to my gigs. And I mean, he is my cousin, so maybe he feels he has to. But at the same time, I think he quite likes the melodies and stuff, whereas it's not really what he, you know, generally buys. Then it does seem to cross. I mean, the gigs, it does seem to cross the board in terms of age groups and stuff, because the shows, you know, when I play, I mean, particularly, you know, the tours I've done in Europe and the UK, where obviously I get bigger. It's a bigger show than I'm doing in this first American tour.
But right.
You tend to look out and you see like 15-year-old girls at the front, and then you see kind of like 50-year-old guys, and you see, and in New York, these twins who are 6 years old came along to an in-store I did with their mother and father who seem to like the records, and apparently the kids play it. They play it to the kids on the way to school in the morning, and that to me kind of sums it up. That I'd like. I mean, a lot of the melodies, I think some of the best melodies almost are like just nursery rhymes or childlike sort of melodies. And if you can add something a bit more intelligent lyrically to it, then hopefully you do pull in a lot of people. But I don't know. That's me trying to analyze it. I actually just play whatever I like, really. You know,
and if it works, it works.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I asked is because, well, let's just take The Final Arrears. Very, very catchy, very poppy. But if somebody were picking up the CD and they see the title...
Yeah,
they think, what is this going to be?
Yeah, well, it was the NME decided it was a song about somebody paying off their last gas bill, or kind of electricity bill. And for me, a song like that, it's quite lyrically desperate. Really, it's about this person who's totally isolated himself from his family, and it's almost easier for him not to try anymore than to try. He's just kind of given up, and it's like this middle-aged man who I do know. I'm far enough away from Scotland to talk about it without feeling that he'll hear it. But it's been some weird instances since I've written that song where this person has been hearing it on the radio. You know, he's a member of my family, so he knows what I'm doing, but he's not somebody who comes to my gigs or anything. But I wrote this song about this person just observing him. And then the choruses are much more uplifting it's almost like trying to give him hope. But hopefully it sounds melodic enough, you know, but in terms of lyrically, it's quite a desperate song, you know.
Well, I think a lot of singer-songwriters, excuse me, get away with that. And it's a good getaway, by the way,
yeah.
which is rapping some very, very serious things in a beautiful package. And it allows you to get all of these things out that you normally could not versus... some of these thrash rock bands that want to get the same message out but really aren't melodic.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I think for me, I've gone through phases, going back to sort of four-track hell. It wasn't hell, actually, but four-track days of in the past of writing and recording hundreds of songs. It was like, all you can do is evolve, you know, and I used to do that. I used to write songs that would just be so left field or so lo-fi that, it just alienated people from really listening to it, you know. And I think what I do now, or what changed in the last 3 or 4 years, which is probably why I'm here and not still in my bedroom in Glasgow, is that I started realizing that it was a case of trying to sort of produce your package or produce your music in a way that it just reaches people, you know. And I'm not really talking about selling out and trying to sort of, I mean, because I don't sit down with any objective when I write a song, but it's just getting these emotions to people in the most direct way, you know.
And what's the use of writing a song if no one hears it?
Well, that's it, yeah. And I've written enough songs that no one have heard, so it's quite nice now that people hear them.
Which is kind of a great segue. You find, I think what I've read about is that you're pretty darn spontaneous, obviously, traveling with a dictaphone and all that. Do the songs come pretty easily?
Yeah, I've just I was sitting waiting on Cammy, my tour manager, in the hotel there, and the piano in the Warwick Hotel in San Francisco just was just looking too appealing, so I just started playing. And yeah, I've just put something on my phone, which is a new song, and it's
called The Hotel in San Francisco.
It's not actually. It's called This Is Hope.
Well, you know, the people of San Francisco, when they eventually hear this interview, are going to be really pleased that, that the song that you've chosen to write about them is...
Yeah, well, there was people kind of like, there was kind of beggars and stuff going behind, because it was in this sort of doorway of the hotel, which is all glass behind me, and it was quite interesting because there was all these kind of people walking by, you know, it was just interesting seeing the sort of, I don't know, there seems to be a lot of people on the streets here, you know, which is maybe a problem for another show, but...
It's the weather.
But so far, we've had a nice time in San Francisco. We actually ended up playing in a club last night. And I did Singing the Blues for some reason. And I did the Final Arrears.
Wow. Singing the Blues, that's a good combination.
I did a nice segue between the two, actually.
Wow. So we don't know that much about Mull. We probably know a lot more about Sky, but I read 2,500 humans and 1,000 sheep.
Yeah, that's about the
what does that do to
stats.
What does that do to a young man? You can tell us.
Well, you know, it leads to lots of problems, lots of medical problems, really. And, you know, it leads to a kind of lifetime of, I don't know, just at least I spend a lot of time in hilltops trying to befriend shepherds. And it's I grew up with sheep in my back garden and cows and horses and none of which I actually owned, but we just lived in the edge of the village. And I seem to spend a lot of time talking about sheep. And actually, this morning when I woke up, this is God's honest truth, I was dreaming about picking sheep, like small sheep, out of a basin and putting them on top of the sort of worktop in the hotel. And I was dreaming this, and then just as I woke up, it was the sound of the hotel kind of, what do you call it, like the water system or something like that, just making this noise, and I swear it sounded like a sheep. It was kind of going, and I woke up to this, and I just thought, because I do include sheep on my artwork and stuff sometimes, and people tend to send me these little furry sheep and stuff, so it just seems to be a theme, you know. And
well, look at it this way. You could have grown up with, like, rhinoceroses.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a messier affair.
Right, that would have been, you know, that's
a legal thing. That's
my 21-month-old daughter would say. She's learned to say elephant butt out of nowhere. Yeah. She just looks, because I guess we've gone to the zoo and I've said elephant butt, and, you know, so I would imagine.
Well,
you're
teaching her relevant words, and it's a good vocabulary to have.
It's a good...
I mean, it helps she could count or do the alphabet, but, you know.
She can do both of that, but she can also do elephant butt, so it's important.
Intelligent child.
Maybe this is also a good segue. I heard you're superstitious.
I am a wee bit, eh?
Yeah, I heard
that. As opposed to religious.
Right. Is there a difference?
Well, I sometimes think religion is superstition, or it's a comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And
something to hang on to.
Yeah, and I tend to sort of have these things where I tend to touch things for a certain amount of time. Actually, holding this plectrum, I've just touched it 4 times with my left hand, so I have to do it 4 times with my right hand, and I don't know what it's all about, really, but...
And if he doesn't, boy, is the music going to be strange. The dog in the wig, just for fun, right?
The dog in the wig lives in Amsterdam, and it was on the cover of the first album, Loss. And I saw this picture about 4 years ago, long before I got signed or long before things started to happen. But I just imagined that this would become a logo for my music. And it's better looking than me, you know. So I thought, let's go with the dog in the wig for a while. And... I actually got named after my grandmother's dog on the island of Mull, who's now dead. Not my grandmother, but the dog is. And the dog is called Trudy. So this dog on my album cover has now just adopted that name. So people call it Trudy.
So does that mean, bad joke coming, that you can name your own record label when you have one like Wolf and Hare or something?
When I have my own labels, when Warners have given up on me.
Wolf and Hare.
Yeah, Wolf and Hare is a good, or Woof Woof. Or,
yeah, you know, or Bark and Style. Bark and Style.
Or the dog's...
I
can't say that.
That can work.
Yeah.
So what would I find on your... weird way of asking influences, but what would I find on your cassettes or CDs in the car? What's your ultimate mixtape? If we were doing a guest set today, what would we be playing?
God. I mean...
Or
what
wouldn't we be playing? That's also a good option.
Todd Rundgren? No.
I have... Poor Todd. He's old now.
I have CDs that I travel with, but I honestly don't think... I started touring this particular tour about 2 months ago, and started in Britain and then over here, and I don't think I've listened to any of them once, to be honest. I've got... I suppose the things that I grew up listening to, even though they were long gone by the time even I was a kid, but things like the Beatles or the Stones or, you know, Bowie, and I like Beck... everything beginning with B, really. And I do like Bach. I like listening to classical music. There was classical music in the hotel room this morning, which was nice. And these are the sort of, you know, the sort of classic influences, you know. But I couldn't say any of them are things I listen to now, you know. But
they're in your head.
Yeah, and I mean now I suppose I like things like Flaming Lips. You know, but I don't listen to a lot of music, you know.
You're too busy playing it.
Probably.
So Silver in the UK for Loss, Us is already, I understand, half that, which is imminently impressive because it's been out for what?
About 6 weeks.
Six weeks. Yeah. Do you find you're probably new to it over here, but the whole thing about getting airplay, you know, beyond shows like mine, beyond stations like this one, quite a challenge because of the music that you're making.
Yeah, I think I like that, though. You know, I like the challenge, and it's very easy. I mean, I know I can write very throwaway pop if I choose to, you know. I mean, sometimes you have things going on in your head which just sound like TV jingles or radio station jingles or something. But in terms of actually substance, I'd rather be known for the music I'm doing. I'm producing at the moment, and it is a challenge. I mean, it's not the sort of stuff maybe I was going to say commercial radio in Britain. Certainly, it's crossing over. You know, it's like
it's so different.
I know America's totally different, but I mean, with the support of people like yourself, then that's what I that's going to be the main thing for me. Really, I know that. You know, and all you got to do is just keep coming out and playing. Like these shows at the moment are quite, as I said, intimate acoustic type shows. But hopefully, if this goes well, I'll come back later in the year with a full band. And in terms of airplay. I just get updates from the record company, things sent through from my manager, and it all looks quite good. You know, you get a breakdown of all the stuff, but I know that really it's just a drop in the ocean, you know. But I'd rather be in that ocean than
than in a bad place. What's it like being on John Peel? Did you go out to the John? What do we call it? The Peel Mansion.
Oh, yeah.
The Peelodrome.
Peel Acres, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I've never been to his house, but
how old is he?
He's about 65,000.
Yeah, exactly.
I did a session for him, and I did a new version of the song where I took my name from, the Mull Historical Society, which is on the first record. And I did a kind of, in my mind, it was like this R&B sort of version, but it ended up just being, I mean, I like the way it sounded. It's a kind of, I'll get you a copy of it because it's on the B-side of the next single in Britain. Off the new record, I've used it as a B-side. So it's good to have people at his support. But I mean, talking the way you were about radio airplay, it's like, for me, in terms of Radio 1 in Britain, which is a big deal, you know, I've been quite lucky that the daytime Radio 1, which is more kind of mainstream pop, you know, they're playing it, I mean, not constantly, but they're certainly playing my stuff. And then it's nice to have the support of people like John Peel, or there's two other DJs, Mark and Lard, who I'm not sure if you're familiar with, but they're they're really, I think you'd like them. They're kind of quite quirky, and they're on daytime Radio 1, you know. They've been really supportive. So, but John Peel's a bit of an institution, you know. He just sort of gets away with, he just plays whatever he wants now, you know. And I think he'll just be there until he falls over at the mic.
One day he's just going to be introducing your next song, and he's just going to drop.
It'll go, yeah.
Exactly.
That will be the final years.
Exactly. So you're doing this, but then you're back and you're going to be doing this, I guess, Belle and Sebastian and the Delgados we talked about, and you're doing this whole concert for Ethiopia.
That's right, yeah. It's a show in Glasgow, and it's been quite a big deal. You know, it's nice to be involved in it. I did a show there which ended the sort of British tour, which was at the Barrowlands, which is a famous venue in Glasgow, which holds about 3,000 people. And it was the first time I'd played it, and it was a brilliant night. But we couldn't be announced as doing this Ethiopia gig until that show had sold out and been and gone. So now I think it's announced that we're playing with this gig. It's in Glasgow later this month. Oh, no. Well, it's May sometime, early May.
And yeah.
I like Belle and Sebastian. I like the Delgados. I've actually never seen Belle and Sebastian perform, but I do play football with them or soccer with them quite a lot. And so it's going to be. And the Delgados seem to be following. Well, we're sort of going east as west as they're going east. They're on tour, as you know, at the moment in America. So
they were in this very room 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Well, they're. I think they're both really good bands, and it's also for a good cause. And it's going to be quite an exciting gig to be part of, you know.
Do your audiences, from what you've seen so far, do they know the songs, or is it very different than at home in that they're just polite here because they're there because they've heard about it and they want to hear the songs?
I think it's a bit of both. I think some people definitely know them, and the way I've been doing these shows is because it's quite taking it really back to base. It's quite raw in terms of what I'm doing musically. I just say, does anyone get anyone want to hear? And people sort of shout out, you know, songs as well. So I think it's a bit of both. I think obviously, you know, I think so, obviously people coming know this stuff, and then some people that are brought along, or some people just maybe are, you know, intrigued to come along. So it's been going well so far. I mean, looking forward to San
Francisco. So it's mainly been, from what I understand, keyboard and guitar?
That's right, yeah. I'm just doing it that way.
Keyboard loaded with lots of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, we've got tubular bells on there and got sort of, it's a little bit more than just piano, but it's, again, it comes down to sort of budgets, and you start feeling like a businessman when you go through all this stuff. But at the moment, this is the best way of doing it, certainly for the first sort of tour. I mean, I think everyone knows it's advertised, this kind of intimate acoustic shows. People know it's not the way I'd generally play, you know. So
because you go as much as what, 10 pieces?
Yeah, I mean, I've had, yeah, sometimes it's like, you know, a lot of people on stage, and sometimes the tour I've just done, the sort of main British tour I've just done, was a 5-piece, and that felt better than ever, really, because sometimes I'm tempted to, I've got an inclination to think bigger is better, and you need 3 choir boys and 2 steel drummers, and but actually you don't really sometimes, you know, just in terms of playing the songs live, because if you go and hear Radiohead, you don't necessarily hear the album reproduced. You hear a kind of raw or maybe a slightly different version of it, and I think that's important, you know, to make the live thing slightly different.
One would hope. Yeah. So tonight, Café du Nord. Now, tomorrow night, you're at Largo in L.A. Do you know the whole Largo history?
No, I've never been to Largo. And the next night, which will be Wednesday, we're playing the Knitting Factory.
Well. I read
so
about that. Yeah.
I don't. I've never been to L.A. I've never actually really been on the West Coast. So this has all been a new experience. So what's the Largo history?
Largo is this small club, but it sells out practically every night, and whoever appears there immediately, see, this is what's going to happen now. Immediately becomes, because Amy Mann, John Bryan, a lot of power pop.
Yeah.
A lot of power pop.
Is
but
that right?
Yeah, becomes, there's a website you can go to. And
I'll have a look at it then.
And the gentleman who owns it is I think he's British. No, he's Irish, actually. Sorry to tell you that. He's Irish,
okay.
And he's... just rules the roost, and celebrity packed gigs, you know, the celebrities go there all the time.
Is that right,
yeah? Yeah, it's considered like the ultimate in hip and groovy. When somebody plays Largo, I was teasing your record company person, Jen. I'm like, ooh, he's at Largo, he must be important.
I don't know about that. But.
Yeah, so it's considered one of these showcase type places
right.
That pretty much people, it sells out.
Right.
Way in advance, so that'll be fun.
Well, it will be a new experience then. I mean, New York was a little bit like a bit industry, a bit punter, you know, like a bit of both. So it's exciting to be here doing it. I mean, I wasn't really aware of Largo's history, so
now you know.
So now I'm nervous.
Now he's going to get on stage and say, "Oh, I remember that guy Dennis in San Francisco." And he's going to have the microphone. Some guy in San Francisco told me this was a big deal or something. So the last thing I wanted to ask you, a lot of your songs have local themes, uh-huh. You know, and others are just about the supermarket.
Yes.
So again, it comes back to that. Here I am, and I've got the CDs here,
uh-huh.
You know, and I kind of looking and I say, okay, public service announcer, watching Xanadu, uh-huh. You know, Animal Cannabis, but then, you know, Minister for Genetics and Insurance,
yeah.
You know, so right next to the supermarket fights back.
Yeah.
Intentional?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, the Supermarket Strikes Back was a song which I wrote very much. It's a sequel to a song on the first record called Barcode Bypass. And Barcode Bypass was just about this guy basically trying to tell his wife, a kind of old shopkeeper, like small store, trying to tell his wife that the 24-hour store, the supermarket that's just moved into town, is basically taking all the business. And he decides to stop taking his medication. But he's almost too proud to tell his wife that this is what's happening. He just walks off with his dogs. On the new record, The Supermarket Strikes Back, when I wrote that, I just had the title first, and I thought, it's such a ridiculous title, I'll just have to try and write a song about it. And that's about the supermarket owner reading the local paper, realising he's caused this, and going from just really worrying about where he can get new blades for his lawnmower, or you know, he doesn't. He's very much suburban sort of, a capitalist man. Going from that and gradually developing this social conscience and realizing that God, he's put this guy out of business, and sort of the song, you know, throughout the song he sort of develops this conscience. And like Minister for Genetics and Insurance is one I like on the record, because it kind of came together in the studio. Just it was quite an abstract song, and that was about this kind of depressed MP like at Westminster in London, who's basically his life just folding in on him, you know, and he's trying to sort of keep up with his constituents and trying to sort of answer to Tony Blair, whoever it is, but basically he just wants out. And I like writing songs about characters, you know, but then I also write writing songs which are just straightforward songs that, you know, anyone can identify with, you know. So,
well, I think it's kind of a harking back to a lot of the bands that you were talking about. When you really analyze the Beatles or the Rolling Stones and you think about it, well, they had Yeah, 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 but then if you listen to some of the other songs and things they were writing about,
Very character-driven
and also even country-driven. There were incredible references in the Beatles songs to the country they were from, and we all accepted it.
Yeah,
we just all said, oh yeah, we know where that is. Aye. We understand that.
It's a good song, and I suppose as long as you can, I mean, like, so the story I was talking about in terms of the sort of shopkeeper 24-hour store, that can happen anywhere. It can happen in Mull and it can happen in San Francisco, you know. So I like to think these themes are quite are kind of international, or just about people. And as long as you're writing about people, then it should work anywhere, I think, you know.
Indeed.
That's the plan.
So, you can play anything for us. What would you like? We'll get the microphone set up and stuff.
Well, I'll play the final arrears and
play the hit.
Yes,
the hit.
And I don't know. I'll play whatever you want. I've got a 12-string guitar with me.
Final arrears is great. Actually, yeah. We played it on the show probably 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, something like that.
And I'll do that.
And somebody immediately, as whoever is my witness, somebody called immediately, like about halfway through the song, and said, "Who is this?"
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and then when I told them, they said, "I'm sorry, I've
never heard of them."
Never heard of them. Where can I get it? But we knew the answer to that. So whenever you're ready, we'll just. What I'll do is.
Okay.
Pause.